The latest push to prevent gun violence comes as Marilyn mourns a 17-year-old honor student shot by her Army recruiter.
A 4-year-old somehow got a hold of a weapon and accidentally shot his 6-year-old neighbor.
As the Senate debates gun control for the first time in decades, we're awash in stories we might never have heard before Newtown. From WNYC, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A new search engine offering complete privacy wants to capture your heart. But are we too in love with our lifelong search engine to switch?
It's almost as if they're like somebody you don't know walking into your house saying, "Hey, I want to be your best friend. Let's go hang out." Who are you?
Plus, Grindr, the location-based app that helps gay and bisexual men hook up, could one day influence how everyone meets. But how does it work?
I got my phone here. I'm just going to open the Grindr app. This guy's called Stud Muffin.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, offering tools to create a website, blog, or online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create a professional website. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Thursday, the Senate voted 68-31 to consider proposals to curb gun violence under the eyes of many who'd lost family members in the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Jillian Soto was there. She'd lost a sister, Vicky, a teacher.
Before Sandy Hook happened, before December 14th, I knew nothing about guns. I did not know that you couldn't, that everybody had to go through a background check. I thought everyone had to. I never thought that anybody could just receive a gun. You can go to your neighbor who had a gun and buy his gun and not have to go through a background check. And that's wrong.
Sandy Hook's 20 dead children, some of whose pictures were held up by two senators from Connecticut, is why that vote took place, why it cleared the threatened Republican-led filibuster. But lately, we've been seeing and hearing many, many stories of shooting deaths involving children.
A 4-year-old somehow got a hold of a weapon and accidentally shot his 6-year-old neighbor.
Authorities in Tennessee say a 4-year-old boy shot and killed a woman in what appears to be a complete accident.
A 6-month-old baby killed not by natural causes, but by gun violence.
In fact, we've noticed more stories of every kind of shooting death, a change in the coverage that reflects a change in the zeitgeist, or vice versa.
The latest push to prevent gun violence comes as Marilyn mourns a 17-year-old honor student shot by her Army recruiter.
Even stories that aren't about guns end up being about guns, like this week's story about a student who went on a rampage with an X-Acto knife.
A community college campus is locked down after an apparent stabbing spree that left as many as 12 people wounded, one critically. The attack.
We wish we could protect ourselves with guns and stuff. We wish that the law would let us carry guns because we're legal adults and carry guns on campus to protect ourselves. But so far, all we have to rely on is on God, but we'd love to have God and the law on our side.
God, the law, and a campus full of lone starians blasting away. Picture the crossfire. By now, you should be used to picturing lots of unimaginable things.
A deputy's wife was killed over the weekend from an accidental shooting at the hand of a child.
A somber Wilson County Sheriff Robert Bryan stood outside the department today trying to explain how a fatal shooting hit so close to home.
All these guns were locked up in a safe, and he was actually pulling another gun out to show somebody there at the house one of his rifles.
At one point, everyone's back was turned to a 4-year-old who reached for one of the guns, immediately killing Josephine Fanning, the deputy's wife.
In the current phase of coverage, the gun debate is presented not so much with data as with anecdote. That's not to say there aren't facts to report. We know from a division of the Centers for Disease Control that in 2010, guns wielded in homicides, suicides, or accidentally accounted for the equivalent of roughly 86 deaths every day. We also know that as recently as last month, in the bill passed to keep the government funded through September, Republican senators inserted a measure requiring the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to issue a disclaimer saying that the gun data it collects, quote, cannot be used to draw broad conclusions about firearms-related crimes. Moreover, as New York Times reporter Cheryl Gay Stolberg told me last January,
there is no central database of gun transactions.
Now, this is not because the federal government hasn't thought of that. This is the result of being essentially handcuffed by the law. Can you tell me what the law is in early 2013 and how it got there?
So in 1986, Congress adopted the Firearms Owners Protection Act, and that law prevents the ATF from establishing a central database. Instead, the ATF has to comb through records, computer printouts, hand-scrawled index cards, sometimes water-stained sheets of paper to gather up necessary data on firearms transactions.
And the reason for this is that legislators friendly to the NRA have tucked certain provisions into bills that have nothing to do with gun control in order to make sure that the ATF's job is as cumbersome as possible. What is their thinking?
Well, I think the argument made by the NRA is that a central database is tantamount to Big Brother. It could be used by the government to send agents into people's homes and repossess their guns. It's interesting that the NRA, in speaking about the Newtown case, suggested a central database of people who are mentally ill, but it nonetheless opposes a database of registered gun owners.
One, two, three. Ready and go. Come on now, almighty King. Help us.
The faces of the victims of Sandy Hook, like 6.5-year-old Anna Grace Marquez Green, hover over the national debate. And every day, they're joined by new faces. If, as the NRA believes, using data to draw conclusions about guns is somehow unfair, what about the coverage of the current parade of gun victims, a procession that was always there, but we never used to see? Is that journalism or activism? New York Times op-ed writer Joe Nocera doesn't particularly care. He pens opinions for a living. But he started the Daily Gun Report, a blog that posts short news items on individual gun deaths nationwide to tell a bigger story, along with much of the rest of the news media.
And the reason is simple. When you live in a town and you read the paper or you watch television or you see the local media, you're only aware, really, of the gun deaths that take place in that town. And not even all of them, because many of them don't get reported. And so, yes, it creates a narrative in the sense that you have a broader understanding of what kind of violence is happening across the country.
I wonder, do you know who the number one victim of gun violence is?
I have no idea. You tell me.
Suicide.
Well, that is true. But what does that have to do with anything?
I'm just saying that I wonder whether anecdotes present the truest picture.
Let me phrase it this way. Journalism is inherently anecdotal. Prior to the heightened awareness of Newtown, you would get anecdotes about mass shootings. You would get anecdotes when there was, in New York this past summer, a cold-blooded murder in broad daylight. You get anecdotes when the police, as this also happened last year in New York, had to shoot a guy 80 times and he still wasn't dead. So those are the kind of anecdotes that are getting in the paper now and have historically gotten in the paper. So what's different now? What's different now is that you're getting reporting and a much broader level of anecdotes, of the kind of anecdotes that are actually so mundane that they don't normally make the paper. And yes, suicide's a part of it. Drive-by shooting's a part of it. Gangland violence is part of it. Handgun violence in urban areas is part of it. And so is people breaking into homes and being shot by the homeowner. And as the country is thinking about what should we do about guns, what should we not do about guns, we need to have a picture of what gun violence actually is.
Newtown drove legislation, which is now driving coverage. Once the legislation goes through or dies, will this window close? Will the coverage once again begin to diminish, do you think?
I think there's a strong possibility that it will. And I'm very sad about that. I plan to continue doing the gun report for the foreseeable future, new legislation or no new legislation. The media, like everybody else, has a short attention span. Something else will come along. And I fully expect that the media will move on because that's kind of what the media does. It's part of who we are.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
New York Times op-ed columnist Joe Nocera. But is all that coverage having the effect Nocera is aiming for? That is, to alert the public to the threat posed by lax gun controls and to pressure legislators to act. This week's vote suggests something may be changing, and an NBC Wall Street Journal poll released Thursday did find that 55% of respondents favored stricter gun laws, though that was skewed by a very high percentage of women.
On Wednesday, the NRA called a new Senate compromise on extended background checks a positive development, but has since opposed it on the grounds that extending background checks would be useless in preventing such tragedies as those that befell Newtown, Aurora, and Tucson. Executive Vice President of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre.
Law-abiding gun owners will not accept blame for the acts of violent or deranged criminals, nor do we believe that government should dictate what we can lawfully own and use to protect our families.
As for the pro-gun senators who did vote to consider gun control legislation, many shared the sentiments of Richard M. Burr, Republican of North Carolina, who met with family members of the Newtown victims on Wednesday. It really does have an impact, he told the New York Times. He voted to debate the bill, but that's about it. He asked, "Is there anything I've seen so far that would move me to vote for new gun laws?" And then he answered, "No."
Leaving Washington for a moment, nearly 1,500 firearms-related bills have been introduced into the 50 state legislatures since the beginning of the year. According to the Sunlight Foundation, roughly half those bills would strengthen gun controls. The other half would loosen them. Thus, there are bills to ban or not ban assault weapons, bans to tighten or loosen concealed carry provisions, bills to require or not require background checks, and bills to prohibit or allow guns in schools. And there are plenty of bills that would nullify any future federal gun control regulations.
Police in Tupelo, Mississippi are investigating a drive-by shooting involving a Ringling's Brothers and Barnum & Bailey circus elephant. Police say that an unidentified vehicle drove by the arena and opened fire at the animal around 2 a.m. According to WBIR, the elephant was struck in the shoulder.
All this attention is different, but it may not make a difference. As Joe Nocera said, new things come along and both America and its media have a short attention span. He said, that's part of who we are. Our guns?
Coming up, all the information from China about a new strain of bird flu is alarming, but at least this time it seems as though we're getting the full picture.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, providing ways to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On March 31st, China announced that a new form of bird flu, catchily named H7N9, had infected a handful of humans, mostly in Shanghai. China has been updating the infection and casualty rates regularly. As of Friday, 10 people have died and an additional 28 are infected. China's responsiveness has earned it plaudits from the global health community, which remembers another public health crisis that originated in China in 2002 and went much much differently.
Web crawling programs picked up some chatter in Chinese, but when this was brought by the World Health Organization to the Chinese government said, no, we're really just having a bad flu season. We've got it under control.
That's Marin McKenna, an independent public health journalist. She says that in the few months in 2002 that the Chinese government avidly denied it had a problem, more than 500 people died and what we now know as SARS spread. Then, in February 2003, China's denial was undone, and a global pandemic was narrowly averted, all because of one post on a listserv used by American public health officials and amateur virologists called ProMed Mail.
There was a note on ProMed Mail that came from a guy who was a former Navy physician and epidemiologist, now operating a sort of private consultancy in retirement in Baltimore. The night before, he'd gotten a note from his former next-door neighbor in Hawaii, a woman who was a fourth-grade teacher now living in California. And that fourth-grade teacher was friends on a chat room with a guy who represented himself as a teacher in southern China. And on that night before, he had said in this chat room, "Have you heard that there is a terrible illness in my city? The hospitals are full and people are dying." So this woman forwarded the note to her former neighbor, who sent it on to this email list operated out of Harvard ProMed Mail. And in very short order, the Chinese government said, yes, we do have something going on that is not quite a normal flu season. And from there, the world was alerted that SARS was happening.
Now, in the meantime, many infected people had crossed borders. The disease was spreading, and apart from the public health consequences, China had a tremendous loss of face. How did the embarrassment attached to SARS change the way the world tracks and reports illnesses?
Up to that point, the world had relied on the governments of individual countries to tell the rest of the world whenever anything of concern was going on. Going forward from SARS, the World Health Organization accepted that unofficial sources of information could be as useful, if not more useful, in alerting the world to disease threats. And they actually put that into the international regulations by which health is governed around the world.
This compact was signed by 193 countries, but no single country is obliged to do anything, right?
This is the sticking point. The World Health Organization and the governments that back it up, those 193 governments in what's called the World Health Assembly, don't really have much power to compel any one government to do anything. The most they can do is persuade.
Which brings up the subject of Saudi Arabia, which has been apparently less than forthcoming with a viral outbreak of its own, something called coronavirus. Tell me about that.
It's really interesting that both of these are happening at the same time, because this novel coronavirus that has been causing illness now in the Middle East since last summer is a distant relative of SARS. To our knowledge, there have not been that many cases yet, but the flow of information around this coronavirus is not as good as the flow of information is around the new flu, H7N9. So it does show that not every country is responding to this implicit demand for transparency around the world.
Does it also not show that if you're going to have a fallback system based on scouring the web for mentions of disease in a country where there isn't much internet penetration and a whole lot of censorship, such a backup plan might not work very well?
I think we like to think now that information will out sooner or later. But it may be that the international health regulations post-SARS that rely on other sources of information can't solve every problem around the channels through which information flows.
Well, actually, I have another kind of good news, bad news thing. It turns out in the case of H7N9, the first reports were not harvested from the kind of social voluntary grid, but from the Chinese government itself. On the other hand, Marin, I've read that the government has actually arrested people for overstating the number of infections and deaths. Which China are we witnessing here?
I don't know what the content was in those Weibo posts that got people incarcerated. Of course, as somebody with Western standards of free expression, I would not want to see that happen. At the same time, when I think of some of the Twitter posts I've seen in English and other languages over the past 72 hours, I certainly don't approve of the authoritarian impulse, but I can understand where it comes from.
Whoa. Give me an example of a tweet post that makes you want to throw someone into the clink. How irresponsible is some of this Weibo tweeting?
Before this all started, there was an apparently separate problem with huge die-offs of pigs, thousands being found
in the rivers.
Rivers,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. The best speculation at this point seems to be that that is not, in fact, related to the flu. But it was a natural response. So the next speculation was, oh, look, we have photos on Weibo of sparrows falling from trees in a particular city. Surely the flu killed them as well. And I think after that, there was a fish die-off. Over about 72 hours, there was a sort of unified field theory of flu, in which flu is killing everything. And, you know, flu doesn't always kill everything. There's a saying that medical students learn probably in their first year, and medical reporters and public health reporters like myself would do well to remember. When you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. That the problem with reporting on scary diseases, and especially with social media chatter about scary diseases, is that we always go first to the zebra. And sometimes it is a zebra. Sometimes it's SARS. But sometimes it's just a horse.
Maren, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Maren McKenna is an independent public health reporter and author of Beating Back the Devil on the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service.
This just in, Wired.com reports that the Google of China, called Baidu, is setting up a lab in Silicon Valley dedicated to deep learning, an emerging computer science field that seeks to mimic the human brain. And, as Wired observed, it makes sense. If you want to compete with Google, best to do it in Google's backyard. The lead researcher on the project, Kai Yu, said that they want to build an algorithm that can identify images and understand natural language and then parse the relationships between all the stuff on the web and find exactly what you're looking for. In other words, trying to beat Google. That's a global frustration. Earlier this week, a consortium of big tech companies, including Microsoft and Oracle, filed suit in the European Union against Google. The charge? Google was using its Android mobile system to monopolize the crucial mobile market. Yawn. How often has Google been accused of giving search preference to its own products, invading users' privacy, and unfairly crushing competitors? And how many times has Google denied its seeming invulnerability in the search market? Here's Eric Schmidt, Google's then CEO, in front of Congress in 2011.
If you don't like the answer that Google search provides, you can switch to another engine with literally one click.
In the digital age, he says, no one dominates for long.
The only constant is change. 10 years ago, no one would have guessed that the vocabulary in economics would look like it does today. And no one knows what it will look like in 1 year or 5 years.
Google is accused so often of not playing fair that it doesn't respond most of the time. But this time, it must have hit a nerve because Google responded on its blog, writing, "If users don't like our results, they can try Bing, Yahoo, DuckDuckGo, or even Google minus Google." Producer Chris Neary has the story about the one with the duck.
Okay, you've heard of Yahoo and Bing, and Google minus Google is just a way to use Google that doesn't call up results from Google products like YouTube. As for DuckDuckGo, you've probably never heard of it.
Sure, Gabriel Weinberg, and I run the search engine DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo is based in the town of Paoli, Pennsylvania. In Gabe's office, there's a tiny kid-sized office chair for his kids to use when they come to work with him. He's just 33, and the company has 6 employees. It's only about 5 years old.
So we've grown about 500% every year. So to put that in perspective, about a year ago, we were at 10 million searches a month, and now we're at about 50. And so if we grew about 5 times where we are now, we'd be about 1% of the market.
DuckDuckGo got $3 million in venture capital funding a little while back. Nate is not an amateur in the tech world. He made $10 million selling an early social networking company. So maybe Google citing DuckDuckGo isn't entirely absurd.
So, I mean, it's awesome. I mean, it's great to be called out as a competitor. They have all this antitrust legal stuff going on, and it's their best interest to say that there are competitors that people can switch to. And we get out of it to be taken seriously.
DuckDuckGo isn't a search engine like Google. It actually uses search data from other sites, including Yahoo. It runs Yahoo's ads and splits the revenue with them. So how is DuckDuckGo different? Gabe believes he's created a way to present the data in a better, more relevant way. But that means different results from Google, and that can be jarring. On the plus side, DuckDuckGo doesn't collect any of your personal data at all, full stop. That's drawn a lot of users and media attention. Still, Danny Sullivan, who founded SearchEngineLand.com, laughed when Google cited DuckDuckGo as a contender.
It would be like a major baseball player saying, yeah, there's plenty of great athletes out there. Look at this kid who's in eighth grade. And the only reason it can really get counted is because there's relatively little competition in the space, that you're almost sort of dredging the ground to try to find somebody else you can throw in there to make it sound like it's a very competitive market.
Google is playing a different game from smaller search engines. It has the resources to be super granular and global.
They're thinking about things like, how do we suggest better related searches when you're searching in Vietnamese for famous actors and actresses? They get that far down into the weeds to do those kinds of specific things, and they have that much talent and that much resources that they throw behind it.
Google said you're free to click over to DuckDuckGo if you're dissatisfied. But is it really that easy? Switching search engines fundamentally changes how you answer life's questions. Gabe says if you use DuckDuckGo for a week, you'll be converted. So I asked OTM producers Alex Goldman, Jamie York, Sarah Abdurrahman, and PJ Vogt to join me in using DuckDuckGo and only DuckDuckGo for a week. But first, I asked them what they use now.
Google.
I use Google.
Alta Vista. Google.
That last one, PJ, he studies improv.
When I'm home at my mom's house using her computer, she has it set on like one of the bad ones, like Yahoo or something, and I don't know how to fix it. So when I'm home, I use it, and it's bad.
Alex had a similar experience with Ask.com when his wife accidentally installed it as a default browser.
I ended up using Ask for about 15 minutes, which was a
nightmare. So what's the noticeable difference?
The noticeable difference is it gives you nothing of utility.
And here's Jamie, our longest tenured producer, on the prospect of not using Google.
Like I would feel writing with my left hand for a week. It seems totally unnatural.
Sarah, who's been called unflappable around the office, was game.
I haven't used DuckDuckGo yet, but I've seen its homepage, which looks really clean and doesn't have a lot of clutter on it. And I'm not as terrified as the rest of the guys because I can't imagine how the results could be so different.
All right, a quick word about our jobs. The most important part is finding stories for the show. Google helps us find those stories. Switching to another search engine made our jobs harder. A week passed. Stories were found, guests were booked, interviews were edited. An episode of On the Media was made. And yet,
if you were learning English in our office, you would think the name of the search website was like f***ing DuckDuckGo.com.
That's PJ after a week.
It's like actually affected my moods. And I was telling you this, if I drink at all, the first thing I want to do is just Google stuff.
And Alex, he missed the breaking news Google gives him at the top of his search results.
I mean, how am I supposed to know what Jennifer Lawrence's dress for the Oscars look like if I can't Google, if I can't DuckDuckGo Jennifer Lawrence Oscar dress and find a picture of it immediately?
Everyone was frustrated, except Sarah.
I kind of liked how the search results had like the symbol of the pages. It was kind of like a shortcut. If one of the search results was from CNN, it'd have the CNN logo next to it or something like that. I mean, it was really clean looking.
Philosophically, I don't like the idea that there's nothing that can challenge Google and that we all just sort of sit back and wait for Google to deliver to us the things that will make our lives better and easier.
That's Jamie, our staff philosopher.
I mean, how else do you get to vote? By, you know, favoring another search that makes privacy job one.
There are some people who have cast their vote for DuckDuckGo. I talked with a couple of them. A few impressions. They were technically adept, interested in privacy, and they go their own way.
I'm a graphic designer, but I'm also a Republican. And I don't know any graphic designers other than myself, you know, that are Republicans.
That's Hugh Roper, a regular DuckDuckGo user, and...
I'm a Mormon, and I volunteer to teach high school seniors. That class starts at 5:50 in the morning. I get up early, I put a suit and tie on, and then once that's over, then I come home, I change into jeans, and I'll usually spike my hair.
After an initial false start with DuckDuckGo a few years back, Hugh says it now does everything he needs, and the search results are at least as good as Google's. The difference between Hugh and my coworkers? Hugh wanted to find an alternative.
I think generally when companies are considered the underdog, they have to work harder. I think they focus on the customer more. And I really don't think Google's motivation is to do what's best for the customer. I think they do what's best for Google.
So I also tried DuckDuckGo. It's been about 2 months. It's my default search at work, and I can say it becomes easier and more effective if you give it a little more time. Still, if I don't immediately find what I'm looking for, I switch over to Google. Danny Sullivan of SearchEngineLand.com thinks he knows why.
For thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, if we needed to know something, we turned to other people we trusted. And in the blink of an eye, we started putting in our most complicated or private or uncertain questions into these search engines. And we built this relationship with these search engines that we use. And these days, we've built this relationship with Google that we trusted. And so when you think about these competitors, it's almost as if they're like somebody you don't know walking into your house saying, "Hey, I want to be your best friend. Let's go hang out." Who are you? And if you do try it, you're going to be really wary of it. If it makes any kind of mistakes and doesn't lead you, you know, correctly, you're going to go, "Well, I'm going to go back to my other friend." If Google starts doing things you really don't like, then you might start thinking, "Hey, I kind of need to hang out with someone else. Come on, DuckDuckGo, let's go for a walk."
Okay, here's something that happened during the course of reporting this story. I searched for the Planet Money site. That's another NPR show. It told me that Planet Money was a dangerous site. And clearly, that's not true. I called Gabe, he fixed it quickly, and then he wrote me an explanation. It was pretty cool. That doesn't make us best friends, but it is a start. For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
Coming up, the Grindr app on your phone is like a gay bar in your pocket. A casual encounter could be just a few feet away.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The year was 1999. The Daily Show sent Stephen Colbert to the UK to report on a groundbreaking new technology.
Gaydar, the brainchild of a young inventor from Surrey, England.
What is Gaydar?
Gaydar is a small device which helps gay men or women meet in the street. It sends a frequency to your one, and your one sends a frequency back to mine, which make mine vibrate.
And that's your way of telling me you're gay?
That's right, yeah.
Fast forward a decade to 2009 and the release of a smartphone app called Grindr, still the most successful location-based discovery app with more than 6 million users worldwide, most of them gay and bisexual men. The app recently celebrated its 4th anniversary, and it's the subject of a new book titled Meet Grindr: How One App Changed the Way We Connect. Author Jamie Wu says that the technology that made Grindr possible arrived in 2008 with Apple's release of the GPS-equipped iPhone 3G.
Grindr was one of the first apps to really use this GPS capability on smartphones. What you're going to see is a grid and you have little thumbnails of all the different guys who are around you. And they're sorted by proximity, the closest user at the top, and then the farthest at the bottom. And in many cities, that would be maybe 100 men within 1,000 feet.
What if you're using Grindr in Montana?
Yeah, so I think the least populous state for Grindr is North Dakota with about 400 users. And I think there it's an opportunity to feel some kind of kinship. I think it ends up being more like a traditional online dating site then because you just can't pick up and go see that person very quickly, but you can still chat with them.
Which brings us to what exactly Grindr is for. And it's not exactly to, you know, find a knitting circle.
You know, you never know. People might use it that way. When I was introduced to Grindr, it was described to me by my friends as a cruising app. And that means that it's an app that was used to help men find casual sexual encounters. There was a survey that was done for 18 to 24-year-old men in the West Hollywood, California area. And they asked the survey respondents what they were using Grindr for. Hooking up was the main reason. But once they were asked for top reasons, rather than just one reason, we saw that men were looking for friends. They were looking for dates. They were looking to break into the LGBT community. And so we see that people are using it for different reasons in addition to hooking up.
Now, the premise of your book is that Grindr significantly changed gay culture. How?
It gave people a chance to take an activity, trying to find other men for sex, and take it with them anywhere that a Wi-Fi or a data signal exists. So they can be on a road trip from one city to another and see all of the queer men along the way. And that's very different because previously we had to depend on either a bar or you'd have to go to a website to find it. But Grindr gave us real-time spontaneous results.
What about the straight community? Is there something like that for them?
You know, they've been trying to crack this egg for so long. Every month there seems to be another app that's trying to do this. And in the book, I discuss a couple of reasons why I think that it hasn't quite been so successful. Part of it is just that there has been a historical tradition of cruising in the queer community. I think there's a safety concern here, especially for women. Certainly, whenever I hear from women on online dating sites, there's a risk of being swarmed or feeling unsafe.
But you also say the real-life dating rituals among straight people are different.
When you're in high school, you learn the first date, the second date, the third date ritual. And as you get older, marriage is this firm goal. When we see apps that are for straight people, they parallel the dating process.
Like the first time you meet someone on OkCupid, you have a coffee and then you move on to dinner or something like that.
Or they'll do a matching game where they say, these five people may have looked at your profile. Try to guess who saw you recently. Answer these questionnaires and see if the other person will match up with you. Grindr strips that all away. Grindr says, this is a person. Do you find them attractive? Do you want to meet? Grindr puts all of the emphasis on gauging compatibility and chemistry in person.
Certainly, being able to find a community easily is a good thing, but you also have some problems with its impact on the culture.
Absolutely. The main frustrations that we hear about Grindr and other hookup apps is that it can be quite exclusionary. So they will say, no fatties, no baldies, no Asians. The thing about the design of the app was that with just one photo and 120 characters to describe yourself, it could exacerbate conforming to the cultural standard of beauty and having people really select for the images that they see in magazines and in advertisements.
Young, thin, white, that standard has bedeviled gay and straight culture for a very long time.
Yes, I think what we're seeing, though, is that the culture is changing. The percentage of mixed-race relationships and marriages, it's climbing year upon year. And slowly, we're starting to see in our media representations of different faces and different body sizes. What we're seeing is maybe just a lag with the queer culture, where they haven't really thought about this quite as much as straight culture has.
What do you think the future of this kind of app could be, outside of dating and sex?
I'm a big fan of Samuel Delaney, And in his book, Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, he discusses this concept of contact and networking. Networking is where there's a functional role to the people in our lives to help support our careers or support our hobbies. Contact, on the other hand, are kind of those encounters that we have that are ephemeral, that fleeting conversation we have in the park that don't necessarily impact us in a direct way in our careers, but that kind of human interaction that brings some joy to us. I think that that's what the discovery apps are trying to do. They're trying to bring in a form of contact where we can meet other people and have those ephemeral moments. LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter are all about networking. So I wrote this book not just for the queer community. I want to see more contact in our lives.
Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jamie Wu is the author of Meat Grindr, How One App Changed the Way We Connect. It's notable that Grindr, a free app, is financially sustainable with 76% of its revenue coming from subscribers to the app's premium version. But Grindr's founder, Joel Simkai, says it was never about the money.
I've been realizing that I was gay since I was 16 or 17. And ever since then, I've always wondered, who else is gay? You know, it's not always easy to figure that out. You know, we can go to gay bars and those types of places, but most of us don't live in a gay bar.
The name you chose for the app sounds like a gay bar.
Sounds like a gay bar? Maybe. I've never felt 100% comfortable in a gay bar. So for me, Grindr's all about finding someone who's nearby and then meeting them. Don't spend time on the app and chat with someone. See what the chemistry's like.
Grindr has 6 million users in 192 countries?
We've got users in Africa, we've got users in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, North Korea.
Some criticize Grindr for promoting a heartlessly pragmatic culture where men openly express disinterest in men of a particular race, age, or body type.
You know, I think there's nothing wrong in knowing what you like and looking for that. You know, a lot of time in our lives is wasted in situations we don't want to be in. They shouldn't be racist. They shouldn't be hateful. And we police for that.
I get the not wasting time part, but no fatties, no Asians. It can be very unwelcoming.
I do recognize that it's sometimes unwelcoming. But if you're not feeling welcomed by one profile, there's an easy solution. It's called the block button. And if someone is saying something you don't like, block them.
In the U.S., gay and bisexual men in 2010 accounted for 63% of all new HIV infections, even though that only represents about 2% of the population. So to what extent do you feel a responsibility for unsafe sex practices that may happen as a result of people meeting on Grindr?
I think I have a responsibility for a lot of different things in the gay community. So when you log into the app, you'll see messaging regarding testing. We also have a page on our website where we inform users about STD prevention.
Have you ever asked your users, polled your users, as to whether they practice safe sex?
Not to my knowledge. There's certainly more that I think we can do. But at the end of the day, this is the responsibility of our users. We're not there at the moment that they're having sex.
Did Grindr turn out exactly the way that you envisioned it would?
I never imagined that I'm responsible for millions and millions of men around the world, places I've never been, languages I don't speak. I've enabled them to meet other gay men. And that, to me, is a blessing.
Joel, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Joel Simkai is the founder and CEO of Grindr. Doug Anderson produced this segment, and after all this talk about the app, we asked him to give it a test run for the radio.
All right, so here I am in the WNYC studio in Soho. I'm actually sitting in the chair where Brooke usually does her interviews. And I got my phone here. I'm just going to open the Grindr app. I want someone who's online right now, who has a face picture, and who's pretty close by. This guy is called Stud Muffin. So it's a face pic. He's a little too cool for school. He says, hot and now. He says, hey, what's up? That's all he says. And he's 593 feet away. He's 29 years old, and he's currently committed. Interesting. He's looking for chats, friends. All right, I'm going to message him. Hey, man. Up for a casual, anonymous interview? Sent. All right, so it's sent. So now I guess it's just the waiting game. Oh, there was just a little noise from a guy called Love Feet, as in L-U-V space feet, exclamation point. Let me see what that's about. All this is a picture of a guy's foot. He's 44 feet away. He's into feet. And he's 52. He says, handsome. Foot rub? I mean, sounds like a nice guy. I'm sure a foot rub would be really nice, but I don't think I'm going to go for that right now. So, let's see. Looks like I got a message. Ah, it's from, okay, from Stud Muffin. So I had said, hey man, up for anonymous casual interview? And he says, interview? Question mark? I'm saying, yeah. Could meet in a park or something. Totally anonymous. Just in case he's freaked out. He's written back. Oh, sweet. All right. He says, sure. Text me. And he gives me his number. And he signs it Jeff. Now I'm going to go to my normal SMS thing on my phone. I'm going to say, hey, Jeff, it's Doug, the NPR guy. And that's sent. And I'm going to say, where, when is good for you? Question mark. And I'm going to say, public place, probably best. Oh, he says, I'm free now. I'm going to say, now's good. I'm on Varick Street. Where are you? All right, so he's on Prince Street. That's just around the corner. He's suggesting the park at 6th and Van Damme. That's Father Fagan Park. Yeah, that'll be good. I'll be there in 5. You'll see my microphone. Smiley face. He says, we'll be there soon. Great. I'm going to head down to meet this guy. All right, so I'm just heading down the elevator. And walking down Varick Street right now. I'm a little nervous. I've never interviewed someone like this before so impulsively. This is new. So we're coming up on this little sliver of a park along 6th Avenue. Let's see where you are, Stud Muffin. Oh, all right. I see somebody. Hey, how's it going?
Good to see you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks so much for meeting on such short notice.
Yeah, anytime.
So I've been charged with getting an anonymous casual interview with somebody through Grindr.
Very nice.
You already volunteered your name. I don't know if you want that on the radio.
Jeff is fine.
So can you just tell me, how old are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
I'm 30 years old. I work in real estate, and I am from North Carolina.
And where you grew up, was it like a small town or a bigger city?
Yeah, where I grew up was a small town where everybody knew everybody.
Have you ever gone home and turned on Grindr there?
You know what? I actually just got home from a holiday vacation, and I did not turn it on. So I have no idea who's back home grinding or not.
How long have you been using Grindr, and how has it changed your life? Has it changed the gay community in any way?
I've been using it for maybe a year and a half or so. I downloaded it more for fun, to see where it would go. But now I'm in a committed relationship, so I actually deleted it for a while and then sort of re-downloaded the app as sort of a joke and just a way to pass time and to talk to friends. I think it is really interesting how the app has sort of changed the community and how technology changes the community, some points for the better and perhaps some for the worse. I mean, the most concerning thing is the casual sexual aspect of the application. On the flip side, you don't have to meet somebody in a dark bar where alcohol is involved, so for the careful user, it could be an advantage.
Is the person you're in a committed relationship with aware that you're still on Grindr, and is that person okay with it?
Yeah, we actually joked last night. He said that he was going to download Grindr, and I said, oh, no, don't. I'll delete mine.
So do you think you would be jealous if he had it on his?
Maybe a little bit.
Do you think that Grindr has killed the gay bar?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I'm sort of new to the gay scene, sort of new to the bar scene, but I would say that it definitely adds a new element to it. You see a lot of people at gay bars on Grindr, but as far as going to a bar to meet people for a casual encounter or something like that, I'm sure that Grindr has taken a significant amount of traffic away from that, for sure.
Just a couple blocks north of here in the 70s was a sexual free-for-all on Christopher Street. Are you more happy to live now, or would you have liked to live then?
I'm much happier living now in these times.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I can't think of anything else. Very intriguing interview, so I'm glad I came out.
Was the interview good for you?
It was great.
Casual enough, anonymous enough.
Exactly what I was looking for. Thank you so much.
I've been a roaming Romeo. My Juliets have been many. But now my roaming days have gone.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alexandra Hall. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ian Turner.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. And our boss, bassist composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Big amount saved up in my love account. Honey, and I've decided love divided in two won't do. So I'm putting all my eggs in one basket.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.